I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is musician Marky Ramone, the last surviving member of the classic lineup of the Ramones. He's joined in conversation by Aydin Vaziri, pop music critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. And now, join me on stage at the JCCSF as I introduce Marky Ramone and Aydin Vaziri. Born Mark Bell in Brooklyn, Marky joined the Ramones in 1978. He was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2002, along with Johnny, Joey, Dee Dee, and Tommy, and has received both a Grammy and an MTV Lifetime Achievement Award. When punk rock reared its spiky head in the early 70s, he had the best seat in the house. Already a young veteran of the prototype American metal band Dust, Mark took residence in artistic, seedy Lower Manhattan, where he played drums in bands that would shape rock music for decades to come, including Wayne County, who pioneered transsexual rock, and Richard Hell and the Voidoids, who directly inspired the entire early British punk scene. And if punk has royalty, Mark became part of it when he was knighted Marky Ramone by Johnny, Joey, and Dee Dee. He promises to share lots of stories from his amazing life and career tonight. He's joined by Aydin Vaziri, pop music critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. So please join me to welcome Marky Ramone and Aydin Vaziri.
Hello, everybody. How you doing?
Marky Ramone!
Whoa. Well, there you go again.
How are you?
All right, how are you?
I'm doing great, thank you. You know, before we start asking the questions, I just wanted to talk about one of my favorite scenes in the book, which is, it's later on in the band's career, you know, towards the end, and Joey and Johnny haven't spoken to each other in about 15 years, and Joey's on Prozac, right? And you're sitting between them in the van, and he leans over to John after not talking to him all that time and says, and John's a huge baseball fan, so he goes, so he asks him, how do you think the Yankees are going to do this year? And and what did John say at that point? This was a chance to make it all better, to become
Well, I wish they would have. I mean, that was, I mean, it definitely curbed his OCD. And it helped him with that, which was great. But he confronted John and said, "How are the New York Yankees doing?" So John just turned around because he knew it was the Prozac talking. But that would have been great because at that point, I think John should have at least, you know, let go of these petty animosities and just, you know, started talking to him.
Instead, you know, he said,
he just turned around and that was it. I know it's the Prozac talking. So
yeah.
You know, we were family, brothers, and that's what happens. You know, sometimes people just don't get along, you know. And unfortunately, I was able to get along with all of them. So, you know, that's important.
That was you, always in the middle, always in between.
Yeah, I was the buffer, you know, in between them, trying to do my best to get them together to make up, you know. So.
Did they pay you extra as a group therapist?
I only got a general diploma. I went to night school and summer school, and which made up for the 10 months I didn't go to high school.
So I remember you talking about this book years ago. When did you actually start?
Well, about 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I just had everything. When you write a book, you have to make it flow. So I'm not saying just year by year, because a lot of books, it's 1990, then it's 1992, 93. You got to make the book flow, and you got to make it sound like you. I went through three different writers. The first one had a nicotine habit, so the writer had to leave my place every 10 minutes. It ruined the momentum. You know, she comes back, and it's like, you know, so that was it. Then the other one, you know, after reading the transcript of the second writer, it sounded like I had the King's English. Like, here I am, you know, at the Knights of the Round Table, you know what I mean? And, you know, art thou thee, and here comes, you know, the, you know, whatever, you know, the guy and his horse, you know. So then Richard Hirschlag was introduced to me, and he was perfect. He got the flow, my the way I talk, you know. So that took that was an experience. That took about 5 years.
Yeah. But I think it worked out well that way because you, by default, have become the Ramones' official historian. I mean, you're the one who can tell all those stories, and you're the only one that's really left that was there through it all. So it kind of worked out, the delay. And are you okay with that role? Are you okay carrying that torch?
Well, you know, the songs are too good not to be played, you know, and and you're in a van for 15 years on a rolling institution with wheels, and you're doing 1,700 shows. You become very close to these other bandmates, and they die too young to enjoy the fruits of their labor. So there's a whole new generation now, and I enjoy playing the music. I tried, you know, doing originals and having my own bands doing originals, but the kids and the older generation who stuck by us just wanted to hear Ramones songs. So I said, okay, you got it, you know. So, you know, I as long as it's fun, I'll continue doing it, definitely.
I think the thing a lot of people are probably wondering, especially when they heard you wrote a book, is how did you remember any of this stuff? How did you?
Well, I'll tell you, being in Ramones, you can't forget, because of all the incidences that happened in this book. I used to bring around a composition notebook that I used in school, when I did go to school. And I have the largest video library of the Ramones in the world. So if my memory didn't serve me correctly, I would just go back and look at certain things. But in the book, it's all there, and everything is true. May God strike me dead right now, you know. So, you know, I felt I had to do this, you know, so just to get it out.
You're a collector. Were you collecting back then as well? You were collecting the clips and the videos and all that.
Oh yeah, I just enjoyed watching everything and how the fans would react in videos, which I apply now to my band to see how they react to certain songs, and then that's how I put my set list together. So it's very helpful.
So let's talk about when you first joined the band. You were already playing around New York. And they brought you in. What was that moment like when you became a part of the Ramones?
Well, they used to come see my band's play that I had before I joined the Ramones, Richard Hell and the Vortoids, a band called Dust. We were one of the first heavy metal bands in America, and they were in the audience. So that I found that out later. Hey, Mark, that band was good, blah, blah, blah. So we all knew each other in CBGB's. You know, with Blondie and Talking Heads, Ramones, Johnny Thunders, David Johansen, you know, you name it. We were all in one little dump, which are called CBGBs. So Tommy, the first drummer, who was in a band 3.5 years, decided to produce, you know. That was his calling. And he suggested to Didi, who visited CBGBs probably every night, and I was there every night too. And that's when Dee Dee popped the question, would you join the band? And I said, well, you know, thank you. Let's go to a rehearsal studio. I did 3 songs, I Don't Care, Sheena's a Punk Rock, Blitzkrieg Bob. And it worked out. And that was it.
At that point, you were pretty well known as Mark Bell. Were you okay giving up your real name to become...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Character, Marky Ramone.
Well, Mark, this is how Marky came about. In the 60s, when I was a little boy, there was this cartoon that represented Marky Mapo cereal. And there was a hot breakfast food like Wheatina and Farina. This was Mapo. And my grandmother used to always call me Marky every minute. Marky, clean the stairs. Marky, the driveway, this and that. So then, you know, I I said, all right, Marky. I dropped a C, put a K there and a Y, and that was it. But that's where all that came from, my grandma and Marky Mapo.
Was there a... Did you experience like kind of a physical and emotional transformation through the name change as well?
No, and my Bells are still Mark Bell, but I mean that's the only difference, AKA Marky Ramone, So at this point in my life, I'll stick with Marky Ramone.
Was New York in the 70s as great as everyone seems to think? Because a lot of your fans are probably, weren't even alive in the 70s. So we have all these romantic images of what it was like playing CBGBs and hanging around with all these other bands. In your memory, was it as picturesque? I mean, was it as great as it's
CBGBs was elongated. It was a rectangle. It was made out of wood, had a great PA. It didn't have any doors in the bathrooms. Hilly owned a dog that he didn't take out. So, a lot of times you would slip on something. That's how it was. And it was our place. At that time, 75, 76, New York was very downtrodden. There was a lot of homeless people, unemployment. There were strikes. From the garbage strikes. There was the blackout in 76, 77. And we had our home, which was CBGB's. The problem was at the time we also had Max's Kansas City, which was a great place too. Disco was big. Stadium rock was big. Nobody wanted to play our kind of music except CBGB's. They didn't want to gamble on a new genre of music, so... We were happy to have our home, and Hilly was like a father figure. So that's what I remember about that era and that time. And then eventually everything got gentrified like everywhere else. So, it's that was the change, really, physically, of the area.
And what was your impression of the three other guys when you first joined? How long did it take you to think, what have I done?
Well, when I joined the group, I thought everyone were like brothers, the Ramones, where they got it from Paul McCartney. Paul McCartney was in a band called the Silver Beatles before the Beatles. And he called himself Paul Ramone because he thought it sounded exotic. But Dee Dee realized that and got the name, and that's how everybody agreed upon it. And, they all liked it, and that's how the band, the Ramones, came about. Like a gang, like a family, So, that's how that developed.
And when you got in there, what did you make of all the personalities?
Well, each individual, you observe and you see, you're stuck in this rolling 15-passenger Ford Econoline van with no escape. And you're driving 5-6 hours a day to get to each show. We weren't into that rock star. Let's rent a big tour bus with the driver, So we had assigned seats. And, we got to know each other very well. Johnny was basically the guy that kept the three other freaks in check. Me, Dee Dee, and Joey. But John had his quirks too. We weren't angels. In fact, we were like aliens that landed from another planet. So, Joey is very shy, introverted, but what a great songwriter, and a perfect histrionic frontman. And then Dee Dee was definitely a whirlwind hurricane. I mean, he made me laugh every minute. If you have somebody that makes you laugh every minute, stay friends with them for life. So Dee Dee was the kind of guy you would be with him, and there'd be 10 people around us, and he'd just come out and say whatever he felt like saying. And then I'd have to go along with him or help protect him, because a lot of the things he said were totally off the wall. But that's what was great about Dee Dee. He had a childlike, vivid imagination. And that's what he did in his songs. because he was very creative when it came to that. So was Joey. And Tommy, very smart, very smart guy. He was an engineer, then he produced. He never played the drums. He recorded those great three albums. And then he just decided to produce, you know. And to me personally, I loved those three great albums, and I loved the lineup. And I said to Dee Dee, "Are you sure he wants to leave?" "Yes." So then I got into the band. The first song I recorded was "I Want to Be Sedated" with the group. So who knew?
Not a bad way to start. When you see a Ford van drive by, do you have a bad flashback?
No, I'm very grateful. Very grateful. You know, could have been a Dodge or could have been a Chevy. You know?
And were you friendly with all the other band members? Did you get along with them away? Or
well, you're there to do a job. You have to get along. I mean, we were different individuals. And the Ramones were the most important thing to us. That sounds cliched, but that's what mattered. Any animosities that were there, you know, that brothers usually have, families have, we left that off the stage. And maybe it helped our music, you know, just because we were all different. And as a saying, opposites attract. So maybe if we weren't different like that, maybe the music would have been different. Who knows, you know? But I got to know them all very well, and we all had our quirks and difference of opinions about politics, about you know, whatever, you know, the events of the day, and so we were definitely unique individuals in that sense.
Were you aware of the impact the band was going to have on rock and roll? And Were you aware you guys were making a difference at the time, that there were going to be bands that followed you?
No, we just played. We just wanted to play the music we loved playing. You know, three chords, 2 minutes, hopefully, not any longer. And, you know, with a nice hook, a good chorus, and that was it. You know, we liked the early rockers, Jerry Lee Lewis, Chuck Berry, Elvis, you know, all those guys. And then, of course, the British Invasion came along, the Kinks, The Who, The Beatles, and, of course, the Phil Spector sound. So you throw that up in the air, it lands, and it's a Ramones omelet. You know, so, you know, we didn't know what we were doing at the time until later. You know, coming to each show again, each venue, seeing bands and, you know, the leather jackets and jeans and all this stuff, and 1, 2, 3, 4 into each song and playing faster and, you know, moving around more instead of just standing in one spot. So, you know, we were very grateful that that band cited us as an influence, you know. And a lot of bands won't tell you that, but the ones that did, we were very grateful to hear that.
And a lot of the British punk bands kind of took what you were doing as a blueprint for what they did, but do you feel like they got it right, or did they get it all wrong?
Well, they were very political. The Sex Pistols album's great. The Clash did great things. There were a lot of good bands there. When the Ramones went there in 76 for the first time, they were on the audience watching. And, you know, the Ramones started in 74, late 74. These bands didn't start yet. But the Ramones definitely gave it a jolt when they went there, you know, especially to Sid Vicious and some of the guys in the Clash and all that stuff. But there was a competitive camaraderie, you know, in England at the time, and in New York. They were living on the dole, which is the equivalent of welfare. And again, there were no jobs there for the youth, and a lot of people suffered from that. So they had their bands, and then they sang about political things, which their audience could relate to. The punk scene in New York was mainly have a good time, forget your troubles, and enjoy the moment, you know, and that's what the Ramones were all about.
You're listening to musician Marky Ramone, whose memoir is Punk Rock Blitzkrieg, My Life as a Ramone. He's joined in conversation by Ideen Vaziri, pop music critic for the San Francisco Chronicle, on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Was there any point where you felt like the Ramones had finally gotten across and that mainstream America was finally ready for what you were doing?
In the beginning, DJs didn't want to play us, probably because of the lyrical content. I could bring up certain songs or lyrical contents that, you know, they wouldn't want to play. But again, like I said before, disco was big and all that stuff, and stadium rock, and now I want to sniff some glue. You know what I mean? I don't think a DJ is going to play that. Things like that. So eventually, a lot of our fans became DJs, and they did start playing us. You know, they got bold, and they started playing us, and then we started playing a lot bigger venues, and, we started touring the world more. So we amassed a large audience, and it became from underground to above ground. Once you sign your name to a contract, all that other stuff comes, you know, the records and the T-shirts, so you are a commodity. You know, that's a lot of punk bands don't think they are, but they are, because we live in a capitalistic society. That's America. That guides our GNP, you know, which is the gross national product. So here I am. I should be on Fox News. Anyway, that's the story. So eventually, now you see the Ramones being played at football games, baseball games, commercials, this and that. So that's what it was. That's what it is.
How did Rock and Roll High School change things for you? Was that?
Oh boy. we were very, very grateful to be in Rock and Roll High School. It was originally going to be called Disco High School. So the thing was, Alan Arkush, our director, told Roger Corman, our producer, let's just call it Rock and Roll High School, get a bunch of guys that play rock music and put them in the movie. So originally they were going to use Cheap Trick, but the Ramones looked more like a band together as a unit. So we toured our way from the East to West Coast to do Rock and Roll High School. So you wait around, you have you're there for 6 weeks, and then they ask you to do your part. You could sit there all day. Your part's only 5 minutes. My big line in the movie was, "Gee, that was a good one, Mr. McGree." And and I was very disappointed that I didn't win the Oscar. Anyway, looking at that movie when it came out and you're in it and you see yourself on the screen, it's like, oh, God. You know what I mean? You know, a face only a mother could love. You know, so that was an experience. That helped us get to the next level because of all the publicity surrounding it, you know, and there were great people in the movie, too. And, of course, after that, working with Phil Spector. You know, that brought us a lot of attention. But making a movie is very tedious, you know. But it turned out well for the budget that we had. And that was the result, you know. Keeps being played today, you know.
And I have to say, even if you guys don't have time to read the whole book, read the chapter on Phil Spector, because what an experience.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you tell them a little bit about what it was like working with Phil? You ended up becoming friends with him.
Yeah, yeah.
After all that.
To the end, yeah. Well, he is probably the most famous, well-known producer in America. He made all those hits, and we always loved what he did. And there was an experiment, two walls of sound meeting, whatever. And Phil wanted to produce us. So we met up at his mansion at the time. He didn't have the castle yet. He just had the mansion in Beverly Hills. So I walk in there with the other three guys, and who's sitting next to him talking? Grandpa Munster. with cowboy boots on, a 10-gallon hat, and Phil's sitting at the piano. And here's me, Johnny, Joey, and Didi with him. And we were discussing, you know, the studio stuff and the demos he heard, what little nuances that should be done, and et cetera. And then we all went to the studio. Phil never pointed a gun at us in the studio. That's excuse the language. But, you know, it's a rumor. It sounds good. I don't want to break anybody's bubble, but he did have the guns on him. He had a license to carry, but he never pointed. That's a different story. When somebody points a gun at you, it's a little different. So he was about 5'5", and they were heavy. He took them off. And he had his bodyguard there that had a license to carry, too. So it was me, the other Ramones, Phil, and Larry Levine, his trusty engineer since he started in the business. So the only thing that I noticed that was a little grating to us was when Johnny had to do that chord to the beginning of Rock and Roll High School, which Phil wanted him to do over and over again. Not to break his you-know-what, but he wanted to have a certain sustain on the guitar, which he wasn't getting on his Moog right. Phil suggested a Les Paul, but John didn't want to use it. So we waited and waited, and we heard that chord over and over again. And eventually he got it, but John thought he was just doing it to bust his balls. But whatever. Anyway, we got the chord, and that was the only thing that I noticed in the studio that pissed him off. But Phil was used to working slow. That album took 6 months to make. A regular Ramones album would take 2.5-3 weeks to make. So it was a work ethic problem. So, a lot of the times he would yell at Didi, and, you know, Didi would yell at him. And, you know, he's from the Bronx, they're from Queens, I'm from Brooklyn. So there was some kind of chemistry there. But it turned out the way it did. A lot of punk purists didn't like it when it came out because of the horns and the strings and who knows what was in there, you know, on that album. There's so many instruments. But they already did their 3-chord albums. So you got to change, sometimes, you know. But now as I look back, I appreciate it more because Rock and Roll High School's on it, Rock and Roll Radio's on it, Chinese Rocks is on it. Danny Says is on it, so there's a lot of great songs on there, you know what I mean? But, it was an experiment. Thank God it was only that only experiment. And we pressed on, moved on, you know?
Right. So as the band's profile continued to build, you started kind of spinning out of control because the lifestyle was just too much for you.
Yeah.
So what happened in 1982?
Well, what was happening was, to me, I was a very hyper person, still am, and I found that alcohol calmed me down, you know? So I liked drinking beer with the guys and the girls, whatever, and then it was the wine, and then I would wake up to martinis. I had a liquor store downstairs that would deliver, and that was very convenient. And eventually, I'd be drinking with the delivery guy. You know, he never went back to work, you know. So I did develop I was a periodic, meaning you didn't drink every day. But when you did, you did. So I never got high before I recorded an album or did a show. But at this particular session, doing Subterranean Jungle, which was one of our albums, I didn't like the drum sound, didn't like the producer. It was kind of depressing because I didn't have a say in what was going on with my drum sound, which I never had a problem with. But this guy was adamant. At the time in 82, 82 and a half, bands were using that drum machine sound, which I I just didn't like, because it there was no feel from the drum, from the shell, the tone, the rim shot, just things. And he just made it sound like that, and I got disgusted. That's why I didn't do Time Has Come Today, which was one of the oldies that were on that album. But I had a fifth of vodka in those garbage cans with the flap on it, where if you don't pull your fingers out quick enough, they get bruised. And the bottle was in there. So I'm sharing it with Walter Lur, who was the second guitar player with Johnny Thunder's Heartbreakers. So Dee Dee goes in there, and Dee Dee wasn't really known to be an angel when it came to drugs. But he stuck his hand in there, pulled out the bottle, waved it around to everybody, and he goes, look what Mark's doing. So it was at that point, Dee Dee was the narc. And, you know, he ratted me out. He was my best friend. You know, I think it was the psych drugs that got to him. But at that point, I was told to leave the band. Joey called me up. He said, you need help, and I understood. So for 4 years, I was out of the group, getting sober. I was advised to do different kind of work, because, you know, there's other businesses besides the music business. So I wanted to stay physically fit. So I did construction. I did demolition work. I put up wrought iron gates and crack houses. Crack houses were big at the time. And now they're condos. So, you know, I don't know what's better. You know, anyway, I had to do that. And then I got a phone call after the fourth year that Richie deserted the group, and that Clem, who I love, great with Blondie, but not a Ramones drummer. So then I got the call, we need you. And I understood what was going on, you know. So I came back, did 10 songs with the group, and it was like I never left. And the first song I did record was Pet Sematary. For the Stephen King movie and soundtrack, and that was it.
Did you play any music during those 4 years?
Well, yeah, I was in a band for about a year with the guitar player, the Plasmatics, Richie Stotts, and we had a band together. We played the local clubs and stuff, but with the style of music that we were doing, it was already getting played out. It was like a metal band, you know. But the Ramones tour manager and John got in touch with me. So, you know, after all the stuff that happened, I knew they were you know, in a fix. So I just wanted to get back and just start playing those great songs again, you know.
In the book, when you talk about your years working construction and doing demo, there's kind of a, you romanticize it a little bit. Did you actually enjoy kind of stepping out of the fray of the
music
touring business and music business and actually breaking things?
Well, it was different. Yeah, it was different. You meet different people, different personalities, different businesses. And you get up 5:30 in the morning. You got to be on that construction site. And you meet the workers there, you know, just regular guys, you know, doing what they got to do. And, you know, the site was in Brooklyn, so I could relate to them, you know. And I got to learn how to use different equipment and demolition especially, you know, heat guns and sledgehammers and, you know, all these things. So I learned a lot, you know. So if I ever had to, you know, back then, lean back on something, I could do that.
And not that much different from your drumming style, so it probably worked out well.
Our physical was great.
Exactly.
Yeah, very, very cool.
Destroying everything.
Yeah, well, yeah. Cracking a few cymbals here and there.
How were things different once you came back in the band? Were they any better or same?
Well, when I got back in the band, and especially when I entered the van again, I turned around and there was Dee Dee. He was Dee Dee King, and he became a rapper, and great songs on that album. Some of those songs should have been on the Ramones albums, and, you know, the Mercedes chain, the Adidas drum suit. And he started rapping in the van so many times that I could have swore that he lost it. But he didn't lose it. The thing is this. He wanted to attempt again to a new genre of music, and more power to him. But Dee Dee was a punk rocker, you know. And luckily we had him on board when he wasn't in the band to write. You know, so that's why, you know, he was still hanging around us, you know. But we remained friends. I remained friends with him until he passed away.
Did you have to resume your role as kind of the diplomat between Joey and Johnny at that point?
I didn't get involved anymore. It's like, it was enough.
You didn't feel responsible anymore.
You know, I did enough already the first time. And, you know, you got to let live and let live. If people don't get along, there's nothing you can do. So I had to think about myself, you know, maintaining my sobriety, making meetings. And that was number one. You know, so, and making sure that I put in all my effort into my drumming to make sure that I did what I had to do up on the stage.
So no one was talking and you guys are driving across the country. You didn't have iPhones to be on Twitter or whatever. What were those van rides like?
We only had maps.
So what was that, just torture all those years in that van?
No, it wasn't torture. I just would start reading. I was signed Rose. If we wanted to sleep, we would just have our pillows and sleep on our rows. But we'd have the oldie stations on because the music at the time we really didn't like, you know, and we would just listen to the oldie stations. And John would have his transistor radio with his one ear plug listening to baseball games. So that's how it was.
Why did the band stay together at that point? It sounds like no one was really happy and no one wanted to be there. What kept it together?
Oh, we wanted to be there. We wanted to play. But it was just all at the preliminaries before we played. Because at that point, the band was bigger and, you know, we were very happy that happened. So why let a good thing go?
Right. Among the personality quirks in the band, you were dealing with... Joey had OCD where you would have to sometimes just turn around the van around and go drive back hours because he needed to touch something. And
well, it wasn't hours. There was just this one incident where we landed from Heathrow from London, and he was touching the curb, and then we drive back all the way to New York City from JFK Airport, and then the next thing you know, he tells our trusty tour manager Monty to go back to the airport because he had to touch that curb again. So that's how deep that went. But in the beginning, we didn't know what it was. No one really knew what it was. So Johnny and Dee Dee thought he was just doing it to, you know, bust their whatever. And he wasn't. He was afflicted with that. And then I realized later that we got to be a little cooler with the guy, you know, and stop tormenting him. So that's what OCD does. And I was sitting next to him on a plane, and he would count the squares in the back of the fabric of the seats and making sure that everything that he counted was right. And if I interrupted him, he would flip out, you know, and he'd have to count it again. So after that, I made sure that Monty put me in a different seat, you know. Because it's just the lunacy. I went through lunacy too, getting sober and, you know, the DTs and the craziness. I had to be a little away from it, you know.
And then you and Johnny had completely different politics.
Yes.
And he was quite vocal about his politics. And he was a huge baseball fan, and you don't care about baseball. So you had to negotiate that whole relationship as well.
Well, yeah, Johnny, I mean, it's already known. He was an ultra-conservative. I was a liberal Democrat, so was Joey. Dee Dee, I don't know. I don't think he followed. I don't think he I don't think he cared. Anyway, so that, again, would create the animosities. John going, well, Reagan was the greatest president. Nixon, they shouldn't have, treated him the way they did. That was the liberal press. You know, he was so happy that George Bush won. So, you know, and we had to keep hearing this, you know, and Joey being the liberal Democrat, me being the Democrat, and all this stuff. And, you know, again, you know, they were just opposites. You know, and we're, I guess, in this country, you know, we have a two-party system, and whatever makes you happy, you know.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is musician Marky Ramone, whose memoir is Punk Rock Blitzkrieg, My Life as a Ramone. He's joined in conversation by Aideen Vaziri, pop music critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at KALW.org.
At the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction, when did he thank George Bush?
Or, oh yeah.
How did that go over with the rest of the band? How did
Not
you feel
too
about
good.
That?
There were more groans than applause. I said to John, what did George Bush do for your career? What did he do? You know, you could have thanked other people who helped your career, you know? So I think he just wanted to irritate the liberal democratic music establishment at that moment, which he did, you know? But I thought it was inappropriate. I thought that he could have thanked other people that, you know, helped with his musical career.
He thanked himself.
That was the best.
As he should have.
I was cracking up so much that that was the moment of the night. You know, I mean, it was just everybody was just dying laughing.
Just all that aside, was it important for you and the rest of the band to get into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame to be recognized by that group of people?
Well, you know, you don't know until you find out. You know, they call you, oh, you're going to be in the Hall of Fame. We were very grateful because we were amongst our peers that we liked, the Beatles, the Kinks, the Who, Little Richard, Chuck Berry, Fats Domino, Elvis Presley, and all these great, you know, luminaries. And we were representing our genre of music, which is punk rock. So finally, we were getting some kind of kudos and being recognized at that level. So we were happy to get in there, you know, saying, hey, we, you know, we're punk rock, we're here with all you guys, so, you know.
And by your estimation, what was the Ramones' greatest contribution to rock and roll?
I guess that sound, you know, that wall of sound, like... You know, it's the Ramones playing. It's that wall, you know, the tidal wave coming at you. You know, that it sounds like an army approaching. You know, well, how we influence punk rock and never changing, sticking to our guns, and people realize that, you know, all over the world. So. You know, we always saw that, and I guess that's our legacy, you know?
When the band decided to retire, when you guys all together made that decision, there was a period where you didn't want to play that music and you needed to kind of step away and do something else.
Oh, yeah. I did two albums with the band I was in, Originals, and when I did tour... You know, there was applause, but they wanted to hear Ramones songs. So, you know, I knew I could never compete with the Ramones, obviously. So I said, okay, I know what you know, my fans and friends want to hear. So I just started continuing to play Ramones songs. That's what I continue to do now. You know, because they are great songs. And they're too good not to be played. So that's my intention, as long as it's fun and as long as my body permits. So I will continue doing it, you know. Thank you.
And you also do the Sirius radio show as well.
Yeah, I have a show on Sirius XM for 10 years already. Who knew how long, you know what I mean? Just goes by. So I only play punk rock. I feel a lot of punk bands, when they came out, were overlooked just because of the term punk. But they had great songs. They were short and sweet. And I want to give them a chance again. And also newer punk bands that won't have a chance because of how the industry is now. And if anybody is listening to the show, producer, record company, engineer, they might like that new band and maybe help them get a record deal or start, you know, putting them on a tour with another group. So I play all eras of punk rock on my show, and I get to choose what I play. So that's important.
That's great. I was going to say, so you're touring with the band. You have the book out. You do the Sirius radio show. And then you have your own line of pasta sauce and beer and...
Hot sauce as well.
And you, and on the side, when you have time, you rebuild classic cars.
Yeah, my grandfather was a chef at the Copacabana in New York. And the 21 Club, he used to cook for Jackie Gleason, the mobsters, Humphrey Bogart, Betty Davis. And Jackie Gleason liked his steak an inch and a half thick. And the mobsters trusted my grandfather to cook for them. They owned the place. So as a little boy, I would go to my grandfather's house with my parents and watch him cook. He was creative. He was a genius with a knife, you know. I don't know how he didn't get his fingers cut off. But I would watch him, and then later on, when I got kicked out of my parents' house at 18 years old, I had to cook for myself. Cheapest thing was just getting spaghetti, tomato sauce, and you could eat it cold, too, and it tasted great cold. Like, sometimes cold pizza is better than hot pizza. So, you know, the spaghetti would last 4 days, keep me going, and... That's how I decided I wanted to start my own sauce, which it took 6 months to make. But what also I like about it, I got to choose where part of the proceeds goes to a charity, which goes to Autism Speaks, you know. And thank you.
Making that sauce sounds harder than being in the Ramones.
Well, it's just another creative thing, you know. I mean, you see chefs on TV now. They're like rock stars. I became good friends with Anthony Bourdain. I love the guy. The beer. Okay, I don't drink. So it will be everywhere in the country. Not like the sauce, just in specialty stores. And another reason why I did it was because part of that charity, part of the proceeds goes to Musicians Without Borders, and it helps musicians. I wish I had that help when I was a kid, but, you know, somebody's got to do it, you know? Somebody has to do it. And the hot sauce, when it comes out here, it's already in Europe. When it comes out here, I want to give it to the veterans that came home without limbs. You know, to help them out, you know, so. You know, if you're in that position to do that, it's good to give back. You know, it sounds cliche, but that's what I wanted to do.
That's great. Are you hoping that this turns into a movie?
I never thought of that, but it's number one on Amazon in, you know, rock, whatever you want to call it, rock autobiographies or punk rock or rock, whatever. Everything has to be categorized, you know. Anyway, will it be a movie? I don't know. I keep hearing these rumors that Martin Scorsese is making a Ramones movie. I heard that 5 years ago. So we will be sending a copy of that to him. And when I see his signature on the contract, then I know it's for real. You know what I mean? But there are a lot of rumors in all sorts of business and entertainment. So when it materializes, then I'll know for sure that it'll be on the screen.
Have you already picked out who you want to play you in the movie?
No, I didn't. I really didn't think about it yet. It's just all the stuff has happened so quick. I'm just so happy I finished with the book. You know, if you ever saw the Jackie Gleason show where he goes, I got a big mouth. So it's all on paper, and that's the result.
It's great. I think we're going to take some questions from the audience.
Okay. So the music industry has inevitably changed because of technology.
Yes.
What are your thoughts about that? Do you feel like, it could benefit, or do you think it hurts artists, or do you think... Because it's changing right now. Nobody really knows what it is.
Well, and when we started CBGB's, there was just a phone booth, you know, and the Village Voice that got the word around about anything. Now you have the internet, you have cell phones, you have all this communication, which gets the band's name out there. But do I like piracy? It's not going to affect me, because we already sold our albums and we already did what we did. But for the younger musician, it might stifle them, because the minute he puts out that album, it's going to be pirated, downloaded. And so how is that artist going to feel when that happens? So it could interfere with music and its creativity for the future if that continues. You know, obviously the artist wants to make a living out of doing what he's doing. So it might interfere in the future with creativity, which is sad, because there's a lot of budding musicians out there that are great. You know, we just don't know about them yet, you know?
Hi.
Hi.
First of all, I want to say I'm a really big fan, and I've been listening to you and your band since I was in diapers.
Is that Dad over there? Is that your father?
No.
Oh. Okay, whatever. It's great that they let you out at this hour, at your young age, you know?
I have a question. So do you think that there's one song or one album that kind of encompasses the Ramones' legacy?
Oh, yeah, the first album. It's just, you know. I mean, when I first heard that, I didn't hear anything like that ever, you know? I was at Max's Kansas City, Wayne County, who I played with, was a DJ there, and he played that first album, and I was living with a girl who had the album, and it just blew everything off the map. I never heard anything like it. It was just so stripped down, and that's the album that should be in the time capsule, you know, that goes to the moon, you know, so... Enjoy your evening.
We have another one over here, Marky.
Okay.
I just have a question about your influences. What was the first concert you ever saw? What was the first album you ever bought?
Well, it was 1964. I was playing my army soldiers and my helicopters and my army tanks that I made. You know, they were models, and I used to use Testa's glue. And that's why I made them, because... You know, while making the model, I felt great. And I wondered why. And then, you know, it was obviously they banned it eventually. But anyway, it was the Beatles. My parents had the TV in the living room, and they came on the Ed Sullivan Show, and I immediately started banging on everything. And, you know, I drove my parents crazy, you know. And eventually I started putting together a drum set at a young age. But my influences were Ringo, and I listened to a lot of jazz in my later teens. I liked Buddy Rich. I liked Dave Brubeck, Take Five album. I liked Gene Krupa's stuff. I liked Mitch Mitchell from Jimi Hendrix Experience, who was really a jazz drummer. I liked Ginger Baker, who was really a jazz drummer. And of course, John Bonham. I liked Hal Blaine from the Wrecking Crew, Phil Spector's session drummer. So, you know, that's what I was influenced by. I never closed my ears to different genres of music because I always wanted to learn. When you think you know everything, you're not going to learn nothing. So I learned from a lot of different people and Keith Moon.
Hi, I just wanted to ask, I really liked what you were saying earlier about how it seems like a lot of people today who, like, didn't grow up in the same era you did, they kind of tend to romanticize the era, but they don't really think about the social economic environment that kind of gives you a lot of unique challenges. And I was wondering, what's your take on some of the unique challenges that new and up-and-coming artists are facing today?
Well, obviously the downloading, the piracy, and I mentioned that before, that it could definitely stifle creativity for the future. So we'll either end up with the music we know now, or eventually there won't be anything, you know? So hopefully there'll be a way where this can, you know, where these musicians can continue to strive. You know, when I started out, I lived in a basement apartment, and I needed a padlock to get into my door, cement floor, no hot water, no heat, and right beneath the window, I lived in a basement apartment, no heat, and then there was where everyone threw the garbage right under my window. So that sometimes an artist has to go through that and live that kind of life to appreciate what he's accomplished, you know. So that's a two answer to one question.
How long did you know Joey was sick?
Well, our last show was 96 in California, and about a year later, a guy approached us to do a show in Argentina, this huge 60,000 capacity stadium, and was $1 million offer. He came by with thousands of signatures. So we discussed it. Joey didn't want to do it. John wanted to do it, and I wanted to do it. But Joey didn't want to do it. And everyone thought that Joey was doing it to spite John, his last stab. But he already started having the signs of the cancer. So that was probably the reason, because you had to start with the chemotherapy and all that stuff. So, you know, life throws blows at you, you know, curveballs. So it really sucked when he, you know, got afflicted with that. So, I think if Joey didn't get the cancer and we had a four-year rest period, we might have gotten together again and did a reunion like every other band, you know what I mean? So I hope I answered the question. Sometime my brain wanders, you know? So thanks. Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was musician Marky Ramone, whose memoir is Punk Rock Blitzkrieg, My Life as a Ramone. He was joined in conversation by Aideen Vaziri, pop music critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Dan Folds, and Alex Espalay. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Tina Pamantuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.